Welcome to Memories and Music on CIGM FM. I'm your studio host, Scott Turnbull, and I'll be providing some music for you a little later on. But right now, an introduction to today's guest, and here's Gary Peck.
This week, my guest will be Art Carr, and we'll be talking about what it was like to grow up in the Dunavan area of Sudbury during the early 1920s. Art Carr is our guest today on Memories and Music. Mr. Carr has been on the program a number of times, talking about or discussing the newspaper industry in the Sudbury area. Today, Mr. Carr, we're going to be focusing on your memories of early Sudbury, what it was like to grow up in the Dunavan area. To begin with, I believe you were born September 17th, 1912?
Right.
What was it like as a youngster to grow up in Sudbury at that time?
That, Gary, is a difficult question to answer.
It'll take quite a while.
Because you have no yardstick by which to measure it. Mm-hmm. That was where you grew up, so it had to be beautiful. Now, you use the term Dunavan area. That was probably a little too broad. Let's reduce it to the area of Sudbury, where all the streets took feminine names, such as Eva, Mabel, Kathleen, etc. And I was born where Eva junctures or dead ends with Kathleen. And so my memories are basically of that little area and the people that lived there. Fred Davison, the GM dealer, lived across the road, and his right-hand man, Ernest Loney, lived across the street from him. But of course, dominant in my mind are the boys my age, the little gang that went around together and built forts or huts up on the hills, dug dugouts, raided new buildings for a stock of nails, and so on. And, of course, in the fall, we raided the neighbors' gardens and made horrible vegetable stews. And, of course, to mention a few names, there's Clifton Butler, Elvin Mantle, Eugene Coe, Jim Scott, and George Simpson. I think they're still active in Sudbury.
Those people were raised in that general area?
Oh, yes. They were members of what we would call the old gang. And, of course, then there were the men, the adults, that as a small boy impressed you mightily. And coming to mind is a chap who, well, for the purposes of this story, had better be nameless. I'm sure those that lived in that area will remember him. He was a carpenter, he was Irish, and a very droll, puckish sense of humor. And a modern word, I think, is empathy. This man certainly had empathy with the youngsters, because we would all flock to his place. In his garden, we could select the largest cabbage.
Were you invited, or just would flock?
No, we didn't have to swipe cabbages in that garden. We could, if we were talking to the man, we could walk out and have a carrot, and enjoy the carrot, and knew that he enjoyed watching us eat it. I think he was a blessing. Many years later, when I was still in my teens, but now covering police court, I looked at the docket for the day, and strangely enough, there was this man listed on a charge of indecent exposure. Now, I hadn't had any personal contact with the man for a number of years, and he had aged. He was old when I first knew him. At least we felt he was very old. And I couldn't understand this charge. But as the case was heard, it became evident. The neighborhood ladies had looked out of their kitchen windows on a beautiful spring, bright, warm summer morning. And to their utter horror, they saw this man spading his huge garden. Now, that didn't offend them. But on a sudden second glance, they noticed that this man was wearing his work boots, his vest, and his battered old derby hat. Of course, someone, very self-righteous, I suppose, called the police, the paddy wagon came, and my aged friend was hauled off to the hoosegow. And now he stood before Magistrate McKessick. I'm happy to tell you that the magistrate only registered a suspended sentence on this man. But looking down at this chap, I'm having difficulty not naming him.
I'm sure you are, but I'd prefer it if you didn't.
He looked down rather sympathetically, and he said, "But tell me, sir, why would you just wear your shoes and your vest?" And, of course, the shoes were to protect his feet from the sharp edge of the spade. The vest, he explained, was, well, a man has to have somewhere to keep his pipe and matches. And I think that's a cute story.
It's an excellent story. How old were you at the time? You were working for the Star?
I would probably be approaching 16 at that time when I was sitting in police court and heard this story.
But you had a sense of empathy for that man at that age.
Oh, I did. I did indeed. Had a very kind heart. He must have. And he kept pigeons. And the pigeons did what come naturally, and they multiplied. And this vast cloud of pigeons flew around and around in great circles above his house every day of the year, summer and winter. And it was a point of fascination with us small boys. We would assemble there and talk about the pigeons. And as we got a little older, we noticed that every Saturday, this man would load up a little hand wagon that he had with pigeon crates. And these would be piled 3 or 4 decks high. And he'd away off to the farmer's market to sell pigeons. And, of course, some of these pigeons wound up as squab, I guess, on dining tables of Sudbury. But most of them would be sold to young mothers whose little boy wanted to start keeping pigeons. She would buy a pair of pigeons, and the lad would go home and work all day Saturday and Sunday with packing crates, building himself a little pigeon loft. He would install his new pets in this loft. And, of course, they immediately flew back home. And this man would point to a pair of pigeons, and he would tell you quite openly that he had sold that pair 3 or 5 times. I don't think he was being dishonest. He was merely capitalizing on the ignorance of the purchaser. I guess, was it a case of caveat entry?
I think so.
And,
expensive lesson.
Yes. Oh, I think they sold for about 25 cents each. Mm-hmm. Of course, 25 cents would buy 5 bottles of pop. In those days, it was still a lot of money. But I suppose the young mothers could well afford it. Mm-hmm. And it helped the old aged gentleman and feed for his pigeons. Mm-hmm. And I suppose he could justify it in his own mind.
Looking back, that's one of the stories that sticks in your mind. And that individual. I think he was a special type of person for the youngsters in the area.
Well, Gary, I could go on about mm-hmm. Jimmy Newman, the old captain of a sailing ship and his little boat, Zip, on Lake Ramsey, when he used to come and say, I need some live ballast. And that was a great day.
That was enough of an invitation.
Oh, yes. And we would luff down Lake Ramsey, going with the wind very slowly. And then we would tack back and forth on our way back. Oh, that was a thrill to be remembered.
One never had to be invited twice.
Oh, to be invited to be live ballast, that was a marvelous.
That would make your day. We're going to have to end this portion of the interview. Today on Memories of Music, our guest is Art Carr. Carr was born in 1912 and raised in the Donovan area. Mr. Carr, what was it? What were the various forms of entertainment for a youngster at that time?
On Saturdays, if you had 11 cents, you went to the Princess Theater to see Tom Mix or your favorite comic.
11 cents?
11 cents, which was an awful lot of money. And if you didn't have 11 cents, you found other ways of amusing yourself. Now, of course, the Donovan area, as you know, is relatively close to the Froude Mine. That paved road that winds over the hills didn't exist in those days. But we could walk. We went so frequently to the Froude Mine, we actually had a path. And we had our blueberry buckets with us, lard pails. And the Froude Mine wasn't as it appears today. There was no great fox wire fence around it with barbed wire on. There was sort of a gateman's shanty. And as the men filed into work, there were rows of, I suppose, 25-gallon metal drums filled with calcium carbide. And nobody told us not to do this. We didn't consider it theft. But we would fill our blueberry pails with calcium carbide. And to a small boy, that was marvelous substance, you know. We could use it in our own miner's lamps to hunt dewworms. And we could also use it for, well, we devised many ways One of the simpler things to do with calcium carbide was to take some of it to school, usually in a little tin tobacco box or something of that nature, and dump a little bit into the girl behind you in school, into her inkwell. And the inkwell would froth and bubble and boil out onto the girl's books. This was a marvelous way to attract attention.
Maddest way to make an impression.
Oh, yes. And then the steam radiators in the old classrooms had large vertical cylinders on each end, about the size of a tomato juice can. The caretaker kept these filled with water. The heat of the radiator evaporated the water, adding to the humidity of the classroom. And a handful of calcium carbide dropped into one of these when the teacher was busy at the blackboard would fill the room with the most delicious stench of garlic. That was another thing. A trifle more spectacular, you could get an old wine bottle with a good cork, partially fill the wine bottle with water, throw in a couple of lumps of calcium carbide, ram the cork in, and point it to it at a chum. Of course, the expanding gases would expel the cork with terrific force and a delicious bang like a rifle. And if you were lucky enough to hit your chum on the shoulder blade, you could pretty near bring him to his knees. That was one way we used it. And then again, you could steal your mother's precious crown sealers that she used for preserves, practically fill them with wet sand, add a few lumps of calcium carbide, frantically screw the top on and chuck it into Ramsey or Black Lake or any one of the little lakes that were so readily accessible to us, and there would be a muffled thud, and all the poor little perch and shiners and sunfish in a radius of about 20 feet would float up to the surface. You had killed them and you went home with a terrific string of useless fish. I suppose looking back on it, it was rather horrible.
I would think so. Are you suggesting that that was the typical form of entertainment? When you didn't have 11 cents, I suppose.
Well, it was entertainment that we did use. There were many, many forms. We had street games that I never hear today. We had Run Sheep Run, which was an organized hide-and-go-seek game. We played a game that certainly was hazardous, known as Duck on the Rock. It was the entire group competing with the player that happened to be it. He was the duck on the rock. And it employed watermelon-sized boulders that you threw. There was always danger of being clunked on the head with one of these. And it was vigorous and exciting, trying to get from one end to the other, trying to knock the duck off the rock, which immobilized the guy that was the duck until he'd replaced his rock, because he couldn't tag you until he had. Another variant of that was Swat the Can, which was a glorified type of hide-and-go-seek. And then we made kites. I remember Clifton Butler was the best one of the gang in making round kites. I considered myself the best box kite maker of the gang. And there are others that made triangular kites. Kite flying was a marvelous way to spend an afternoon. There's nothing more gratifying than feeling the gentle tug of a kite string and watching something that you created defy the law of gravity. I've been asked to judge kite flying. I refuse, because there won't be a homemade kite in the group. They'll all be store-bought. Then again, back to calcium carbide, and this almost approaches vandalism. We would run up a water-filled rut when we saw a car approaching, and we would fill 20 to 40 or 60 feet of that rut with a sprinkle of this carbide, and the chap posted at the end of the rut would light a great huge wooden match and throw it into the rut, and the oncoming motorist would be confronted with flames 4 feet high from this rut, and he usually wound up on somebody's lawn. I can't remember a car ever being damaged. But then, of course, you must remember that my father told me, boy, if the police are chasing you, don't run home, run the other way. And this we did. And, of course, we had huts, forts, we called them, built in the hills, which didn't have houses on them. We also had dugouts where we dug holes and put roofs on them. And I suppose it was theft. We went to new construction sites for a stock of nails. The nails were always there in wooden kegs. And the wooden kegs, when they were nearly empty, we'd dump the nails out, because the wooden kegs made wonderful stools mm-hmm. in our forts and huts. We even had cook stoves in some of them. When two of my sons were approaching their teens, I took them for a walk up the CPR track out of Sudbury heading west, took them back onto one of the hills to show them where we had built a hut when I was their age or younger. And lo and behold, there was the remnants of the old cast iron kitchen stove and the sheets of corrugated iron that we had gathered here and there to form a wet, watertight roof. And I can remember my two boys being absolutely thrilled at having found the spot where their father had played, mm-hmm. and he was younger than they were.
Back in the days when the youngsters really had to organize their own entertainment.
Yes, we had a swimming pool in that little creek that flows down in that cleft of the hill. We made a dam with old railway ties. But I think we're coming to the end of our time.
Yes, we are, in terms of that aspect of the interview. Welcome back to the interview portion of Memories and Music. Our guest today is Art Carr. We've been talking about entertainment in Sudbury during the early 1920s and what it was like to grow up in the Donovan area as a youngster. Mr. Carr, I believe you were involved or associated with what was known as the Star League, a hockey organization, or a hockey league, rather?
Yes. We talked earlier about Bill Mason and things that he did for the town. Organized hockey for small boys was absolutely unknown. And the Star League was organized by the Sudbury Star. So the impetus had to come from Bill Mason. And every ward of the city had its own boys' hockey team. They were centralized in wards, not at schools. So you see, we would have separate school players, usually Irish or French Canadian, on our team. And these teams were named after animals. I can't recall them all. I think there was the Fernie Ward Bearcats and the Ryan Ward Lions and so on and so
right.
on. And Saturday mornings, at the old palace rink, we would have the ice service for the entire morning, and we would play leagues, competitive hockey, with coaches, usually ex-pros. Joey Ironstone comes to mind. Jumping Joey, the famous goaltender. Sammy Rothschild, another name. Shorty Green and his brother Red also coached teams. Now, these men I mentioned formed the first New York American team. And in the eyes of us small boys, they were simply marvelous. And when they told us what to do and demonstrated how to do it, we really tried hard, because these were the experts.
You were with the pros.
Oh, yes. It was marvelous, you know. Now, I could skate. I could skate backwards faster than most of the boys could skate frontwards. I could stick handle not too well. I was terribly weak on the shot. We didn't have the slap shot. The slap shot was ridiculed as golfing. It was entirely wrist shot in those days. The blue line was very close to the goal crease, I think about 12 feet. There was no forward passing whatever, except behind your own blue line. So you had to work out short passing plays, and you pass slightly backwards, or you'd be called on the offside. And to be called on the offside made you look a trifle ridiculous, as if you didn't know what you were doing. And you were very careful not to be called, because if you were called too frequently, you'd be benched real quick, and you would be told rather blisteringly what you had done wrong. And boy, to offend an ex-professional player was just a no-no. Believe me, we boys worked hard at it. I don't know what to tell you to elaborate.
You mentioned a number of the professionals. Hector Blake, course, who was grew up in the Victoria Mines area, born in that community. Did he play in the league?
Not in the school league. When you left the school, your primary school, you were out of the Star League. And you hoped you would be picked up by a mercantile league team. Now, Sudbury was hockey mad. Their juniors won the Memorial Cup time and again. And I knew all of the players on those teams and had played with many of them. We mentioned Art Cressy. He was backup goalie behind Bill Dernan in one of our Sudbury's championship teams. And I have played hockey with Art Cressy. However, I mentioned you'd like to be good enough. You would apply and go for a tryout, and oh my, it was marvelous if you made the team. Now, Toll was introduced, and he was quite young, as a possible Sudbury junior. But his first year in Sudbury, he was a few years younger than I, and a gangly youth, as I recall him. And really, we didn't consider Toe had any potential. That's a horrible thing to say, mm-hmm. isn't it? And I actually
How wrong
played,
people could be.
Yes, I actually played posing wingman. I can't recall. Now, I did stints with Sudbury Canoe Club, with Cochrane Dunlop Hardware, and with the Knights of Columbus. Over a three-season spell. And I really can't tell you who the coach was when I was playing with Toll because he was an unknown at that time. In fact, we were not aware of his nickname. He was Hector. And of course, you know how he got the Toll, didn't you? How his little sister.
Why don't you repeat it on the air now?
Well, his little sister had trouble saying Hector. She could get the last, but it turned out to be Toll. And his family adopted that, and he was Toll Blake, and still is.
And has stuck with him.
Yeah.
You were involved in organized sports. Also, you played in a band, I believe.
Yes. Both brass. I was a member of the GWVA and Citizens Band.
Great War Veterans?
Yes, the Great War Veterans Association. And then I was playing clarinet, woodwind. I managed to get enough money to buy an alto sax and became a member of, well, several minor dance bands, including one with the amusing name of Bill Orange and His Lemons. And Bill Orange was the boy's name that led the band. He later went into medicine. I think he practiced in Sudbury, Dr. Orange. Then I was picked up by Henry Norris and his Midnight Ramblers. I would say that the Norris Band was one of the two top-flight bands. I would identify the other as Art Gimpoli's band. And I was very proud to be picked up by Norris. Guy Lombardo was just making the sax trio, very sweet and very popular. A sax trio required two altos and a tenor. There were no tenor sax players in Sudbury. Pardon me, there was one, Eddie Cicchetto. And Eddie played with Art Gimpoli. Norris needed a tenor sax player. He'd heard me at dances. And he laid out a deal whereby, employed in his band, I could indeed pay for a new tenor sax. And I went for it, and I never regretted it. I also had to double on a flute. And somebody will remember out there the old dance hit that Ozzie Nelson made famous. I'm looking for a guy that plays alto and clarinet and doubles on a flute and wears a size 37 suit, because that is what I was doing at the time, only I played tenor. I guess that's why that song hung.
I'm sure that's why it's lingered in your memory. Now, you've provided us with examples of entertainment that certainly kept you busy as a youngster. You began to work in the newspaper business, I think, was at age 13?
Yes.
Did you stay in the band while you were working with the newspaper?
Oh, yes. And you would be out until 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, depending how far you had to travel.
You had a 9-hour day with the newspaper.
Yes. But you were young and resilient, and I learned to turn things off and go to sleep almost instantly. We would travel to Capriol. Of course, that's just a few minutes today, but it was...
A trip then.
It was a trip. And we could get into the back seat of the enormous old cars And I could go to sleep almost instantly and awaken when the car stopped. Mm-hmm. And you learned, I think, to conserve your energies. You played at Falconbridge. And to play for the Coppercliffe Club was quite an honor. And I'll tell you that for some years, Norris's band was the only dance band that played in that lovely place where the dance floor was suspended on chains so that it would have a resilience. And these chains were tightened with great turnbuckles. And the steward adjusted the buckles as the crowd demanded.
An early example of special effects.
Yes, marvelous.
We're going to end our program on that note. We'll return in a few minutes with a wrap-up. Welcome back to the concluding portion of our program today on Memories and Music. Our guest is Art Carr. Mr. Carr, most recently you've been the publisher and editor of the Palmerston Observer. You were born in Sudbury in 1912 and left the community, was it during the 1920s?
Yes, late 20s.
You get back to Sudbury now and again, I assume?
Yes, I do.
When you look back on the years that you spent in Sudbury, what were some of the values that were instilled that have probably served you well through the years?
Gary, when I started to work, my father said to me, quite seriously, he called me boy because I was an only son, I guess. He said, boy, always do a little more than you're paid for. Always do a little more than is expected of you. And then I was fortunate in that I worked with good craftsmen in the trade or profession. And I saw that they were doing exactly what my father told me to do. And they sort of clinched the nail that my father had driven. So I tried to do a little more than was expected of me. And as the years rolled by, I found that by and by, people were expecting more of me than I could deliver. But then, Gary, I think you know that in this life, it's what, 80% BS and blustering? And 20% actual fact.
This program accepted, I must say.
So I have managed to obfuscate questions, I guess, pull statistics out of the air, and build up defensive mechanisms to protect myself and those close to me. And I've managed to survive in this game of life. And it's a glorious game, you know. And now, I suppose the curtain is coming down, but I don't think so. I'd like to go on to about 120 and then be shot by a jealous husband. I think that would be ideal.
That would make an interesting epitaph.
Yes, it would, yes.
On that note, we're going to end the program on that note of optimism on your part. And though you've made reference to the fact that one often likes to cloud the issues as a defense mechanism, I think that really over the considering the last number of programs that we've had, I think you've, in a sense, revealed your soul. I've found it most fascinating, your recounting of early Sudbury history and what it has been like to be a newspaper man. And at this time, I'd like to thank you on behalf of our listening audience. Thank you very much.
And I hope you've enjoyed Memories and Music for this Sunday afternoon, brought to you by International Nickel. Mr. Carr, certainly an interesting guest. Thank you very much to him. And hope you'll join us again next Sunday afternoon at 1, when we'll have another interesting guest. This is Scott Turnbull. Have a pleasant afternoon.